Okay, you still there?
Yeah, how do you record this? Do you have like an app that records your phone calls?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, good.
Called taped call. So, well, I mean, probably all of our calls are being taped by the NSA anyway.
Yeah, well, whenever I talk about something, it shows up as an ad in Facebook. Like, even if I'm not typing it, I forgot what it was. It happened with a friend of mine last week. I think we were talking about Fleetwood Mac tickets, and then Fleetwood Mac tickets show up in my Facebook. Like,
yeah,
your phone is listening to you somehow.
So, how are you doing?
Good.
Am I catching you at an all right time? I know you said you were working on something.
Yeah, I'm like always doing something. I'm trying to mix a band that I recorded a couple weeks ago, and I've got some taxes to work on, and a video to edit, and something else.
Yeah, always staying productive. Well, I think that that's probably going to be a theme with you, that you were a super prolific and productive artist.
In some ways. I mean, I've had none of my bands, except for maybe Lorelei, have a lot of releases. Some of them just have no releases or just a cassette. But it's a long number of years. I mean, I think my first vinyl was Mixed Nuts Don't Crack compilation that Media Disease was on. That was 1983.
And I've noticed that, I guess, for I found a website that I think that you probably put together at some point that that had all of your recordings on there, or it had like a list of recordings and then sort of a description of each one. Tapes, like everything. It was an even more comprehensive list than the one that was on Bandcamp.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I assume that you put that together.
I know I made a tripod page that had all my bands, but not all my releases.
Okay.
Well, that's weird. I'll have to look for that. I don't know what they all are. I went to band to band after I sent you that link. And there were like two releases I'd never heard of.
That they were saying that you were on?
Well, I was on their compilations that Lorelei was on.
Oh, okay. But you weren't even.
Something we gave to them in the 90s.
Yeah.
And I guess it just keeps getting regurgitated and comes out again on the new comp.
There were so many compilations going around in like the 80s and 90s. You know, there were just tons and tons of compilations. So it could even be something that you've, you know, forgotten about.
Yeah, well, thankfully, a bunch of them were in Europe. There's a whole, I never thought that I would, you know, my music would be in Europe, so that's kind of cool.
Well, I mean, I was looking for your releases online, and I just noticed that, you know, it's not as easy to find all the stuff online that's on the that is on the Band to Band page.
Yeah, someone's supposed to be archiving that and putting it all out, and that person is me. and I have not done that yet. I think in 2010, I started like finding all the DAT tapes and ADAT tapes and compiling them, but it always just got put back on the back burner.
Well,
I'll do it one day.
I think it would be great if you had your own website or even your own like Bandcamp page or something like that that just compiled all of that and you could, you know, listen to and purchase everything. That would be really cool. Because there is so much of it, and it's such a diverse career that you've
you're just kind of searching things around, it's hard to figure out, well, okay, what's here on YouTube? What's on Spotify? What's on, you know, any of the different places that you might listen to stuff?
I mean, I think I'm going to put it all on YouTube. I just put up a Dane Bramage bootleg last night. That was Dave Grohl's teenage band called
mm-hmm.
Dane Bramage. And my friend Dave Rickard had a cassette of them playing in 1987. And the band found out about it. The band who's not Dave Grohl, the other two guys. And so I just digitized that last night and put it up on YouTube. That seems like the best place to put stuff because people do searches. It's weird. It's a video site, but it's the best place to find music.
Well, they're definitely trying with their YT Music app to be, you know, competing as a music streaming service. But I know with this podcast, like, I probably couldn't even do this podcast, or I wouldn't be able to have half the music that I have on the podcast if it wasn't.
Yeah.
So it is. It's a warehouse of like a whole musical history that's up there.
I guess it's kind of like all the copyright stuff has been either people don't care or it's been deregulated. Because when there was Napster, that got totally pounced down upon. I guess maybe it was so easy to share stuff, and then YouTube. It's like, oh, it's not an audio file, it's a video. You can't just put it in your pocket and take it with you. It became just, I guess, the fact that it wasn't, illegal and whatnot. And anything you want is on there. Like, I've been looking, there's an all-girl band from the 70s called Fanny that... people have been rediscovering lately, and they have all this video footage of them on German television and the Sonny and Cher show and whatnot. And I know that at the time, everything was, there was a contract and, music couldn't be distributed and all this stuff. And it seems to have just gone by the wayside for better or worse.
Well, I've had situations where, because I post all my podcast episodes up on YouTube. Also, the Jams for Men YouTube page. And I've had situations where I've included songs and I tried to post it and it said that there was a copyright infringement and it wouldn't allow me to post it. I had that happen with a Prince song. I had that happen with a Sepultura song.
Yeah, I put up a movie, like a movie I acted in the 90s, and it had a Tom Jones song, but I think it's just any money they make goes to Tom Jones. They didn't take it down. It had some kind of, copyright notice, but it was still up. It's just whatever money gets made goes straight to Tom Jones.
Yeah, they'll post that to you also. There are some that you'll get that copyright notice, but it'll still allow it to be posted. I'm saying that there are others that they won't even allow it to be posted. It'll be blocked. So I think it depends on the record company. It depends somewhat on the rights and how active they are about allowing or blocking some of that material.
Well, I'm happy to have whatever is up there, because I enjoy discovering it on my downtime.
and you feel that way about your own music too?
Yeah, I know that the Foundation albums are up there, and Uruku, and I think some Media Disease might be up there. I don't get upset about it.
Good. Well, now that you're bringing all these releases up, let's go back to the beginning of you kind of playing music, and maybe we can chronologically try to hit a bunch of these bands that you've been in and done these releases through. Where did it start musically for you?
Probably unlike most of the people you interview, like I wasn't making music as a teenager in high school, which is the best time to make it because you can come home from school and play drums for 3 hours and get good at your instrument. Like I was pretty much 20 or 21 before a coworker said, do you want to buy my drum set? And I thought about it, like, okay. And then I had a neighbor and he would play like UK subs and all this cool punk rock I would hear out of his back window. I didn't know who he was. He was just some kid who lived next door to my dad in the Second Life. Finally, I met him, and he played guitar, and so we started jamming in a band called Contaminated Product. We played maybe one party, and around that same time, I met John Cobbett, who's the guitarist for Media Disease. I think he'd seen me at some shows, and he came to my movie theater. He was around 15. I guess I was 21 or 22, and he said, hey, are you a Georgetown punk? And I'm like, well, not really. I know who those guys are. I don't think they would, they wouldn't let me into their club, I don't believe. And he's like, yeah, I'm trying to start this band. And he's really downtrodden because he went to Madison High School, and the jocks would beat him up and like put his head in the toilet. Put him up in a tree with his jacket, like they would put him in a tree with a branch behind his jacket and then zip his jacket up and then laugh and leave. And so, a typical punk rocker. And so I was like, let's jam. Let's do some punk rock. And that was the genesis of Media Disease.
And did you have your own house at that point? Where were you living?
I lived with my mom in Sterling at that point. I think I lived on my own around 23. I had an apartment in Seven Corners. A bunch of punks lived nearby. There's a band called Scam and Scream. The guys from Scream lives by there. It's kind of a cool mini scene. You could carpool the shows with people from Seven Corners. But now I live with my mom. We practice at my mom's house briefly, and then mostly we practice at John Cobbett's house. And eventually his brother, who was 13, joined because we couldn't find a bass player. Like, we wanted to have a girl bass player for some reason, just because it looked good on stage. And we would audition. I would meet some girl at a show, and they would all say, oh, yeah, I play acoustic guitar. And we'd do an audition, and they weren't good at bass. And then eventually his little brother was like, I'm as good as anyone you've had audition. And he was a cute little 13-year-old kid, so that fit the bill.
Yeah, that's got to look somewhat cool or interesting on stage.
Yeah, if you go to the Band in D.C. book, do you know that book?
Yeah, of course.
There's the media disease picture. You know, he's in there. You know, there's a guy who's 23, a guy who's 15, a guy who's 18, and then a bass player who's, you know, 5 foot tall and he's 13. It's very cute.
And you guys played shows with him? Like, you played clubs?
Yeah, that show was at 930 Club. It was the album release for the compilation, Mixed Up Snow Crack. And by that point, we were on our third singer. Getting a singer for that band was also very difficult. I think we probably did a year and a half without playing a show, just writing. And, our singers were not very good timing-wise. And finally, we got a guy, John Lorenz, who was perfect. And we played our first show with him, but we'd been a band for a year and a half.
Was it easy for you guys, being from Northern Virginia, booking shows in D.C. at that time?
No. A common thread, I think, of this podcast is people saying that the D.C. scene is very cliquish and insular. I don't fault it too much for that now, but at the time, I felt that was the case. And although it's a band like Void, we're from Columbia, Maryland, you know, in the heart of Prince George's County. And if you're good enough, you're accepted. I mean, Media Disease was not a great band, so I can't really fault us our lack of success to cliquism, if that's a word. But yeah, we had a difficult time. I mean, our demo was ridiculed by Discord people. They're all my friends now, but at the time, you know. We even had a fake show. Like, this is someone called John and said, hey, do you want to play at the Chancery? Which was a venue on New York Avenue. That's where I first saw the Teen Idols. That's where I first saw Government Issue. But I thought it had been closed as a venue. And John's like, no, we're playing. We're open for the Obsessed. It's a last-minute show. And we just gotten our new singer, John Lorenz. So we show up there. It's raining. It's like a torrential downpour. And we have all of our equipment. And there's no show. It's just someone was playing a trick on us.
Oh, man.
And I laugh now. I chuckle about it. But our singer, John, was just running up and down the street. I know you're watching me, you mofos. I know you're watching me. It's a good scene for the movie, if anyone ever makes a movie about Media Disease.
That is rough. That is to play on an upcoming band.
Well, I know who did it, actually. I found out years later. And I'm not plotting my revenge or anything, but unless something really brilliant comes to me. But no, I don't have many, I don't harbor any ill will towards those people. Like, I still, you know, I'll talk to Ian MacKay once every 2 years for like 5 minutes. And and Brendan from Fugazi. You know, I know him through Common Friends now. So
they were the ones that played the joke?
No, no, don't say that. No, it was a guy named Jason. Like, it wasn't even a band guy. But just the general, you know, the media disease in a nutshell was a band that was poorly received. But it's kind of cool that when we're mentioned now, we're like, oh, why weren't these guys bigger? You know, they sound like total DC hardcore. You know, stuff I read now is very complimentary. But that wasn't really the case. We played Wilson Center. We played a show with Void. We played. We had some good shows. We played Government Issue is a common theme with me. Government Issue was always nice to my bands, John Stab.
And how did you get into all this music? Was it that neighbor that was playing that stuff, or did it start earlier? Because you said you didn't start playing music till 21, but how did you get into all of this DC punk music?
I think I didn't know it existed. I'm of the age group, because I was born in 1960, where I should have been going to late 70s, just, you know, the Slicky Boys and the DC's and Nightmare and all the cool DC bands before hardcore. But living out in the suburbs, I didn't know anything about that kind of music. But when the Sex Pistols and the Ramones and the Clash, when that all started breaking, I stopped listening to the Doors. I stopped listening to Alan Parsons Project. I stopped listening to Yes briefly. I'm now back with Yes. And I stopped listening to power, you know, poppy music like the Carpenters. Like, I was a total lightweight up until Sex Pistols, Ramones, Clash, you know, 77. And then, but yeah, the kid through the window, he told me about the hardcore scene. And so he took me out to my first show, which was the Cramps and Teen Idols were opening. And like Mike Davis told you in his interview, you know, music was an unreachable goal for, you know, anyone like me until you see the Teen Idols and, oh, anyone can do this. Why not me? And then maybe a few weeks later, we went to a Teen Idols show at the Chancery and it was kind of great. I had a few incidents there I won't go into. I'll sound too depressed about the scene, but I did enjoy the scene there. I mean, my first exposure to hardcore, like instantly, I'm like, oh, I can be. I want to start a hardcore band.
And then you did.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, in a sense, it's kind of expected. It's one of those scenes where anyone, you know, Andy, what were you in a band, Andy?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And yeah,
anyone in the audience, you're obliged to be in a band in the hardcore scene.
Yeah. I mean, with me, that's the thing. I don't know that I even have any musical talent whatsoever, but I've been such a fan of music for so long. And just, I'm so passionate about music that I just felt I needed to be around it. I needed to make it. I just wanted to do it. And so I've manifested that. I just love so many different kinds of music that I've sort of tried to make all of them at one time or another. And I can see that somewhat in your discography also. You know, there's definitely a through line of hardcore, you know, or, you know, louder, aggressive kind of music like you were doing in, let's say, Malefice. But, you know, there's also this really melodic and I don't know, like, psychedelic aspect to a lot of the music that you make too.
Yeah, I think it's pretty eclectic. Even with Media Disease, you wanted to have like a saxophone player and just be something that was different. But we need to get to the rest of the scenes. I need to jump ahead a few years really quickly here. But yeah, I did that, and then Media Disease turned into Malifice because the same guy, John Cobbett, eventually got really good at guitar, and he started doing metal riffs. And I wasn't then, and still I'm not, a big metalhead beyond the Power Slave album by Iron Maiden. That's a great album. But his drummer was a great metal drummer, but he would never play a show. He's like, oh, we're not good enough. And eventually the band got sick of it and like, let's get Davis. He's not that great, but we can play shows. He'll show up and he'll learn the songs. So I did Malifies for maybe eight or nine months. And then, you know, we played 4, 5, 6, 7 shows. And by then I felt, you know, they can find a drummer now. They're out there. They're doing something really unique. So my time with Malifies was pretty short, but it's very enjoyable. Yeah, they had a drummer after me. Actually, Colin Sears from Pudwack.
Mm-hmm.
He was playing with Mike Davis and Sean Philpott and Dave Allen. And I was playing in Malifies, and they wanted to start practicing like 3 times a week. I'm like, dudes, I can't do 3 times a week. But, you know, I think you can find someone. So they got Colin. And I know he never practiced 3 nights a week because he lived in Bethesda. But they got Colin. And then I joined the Pudwack guys. So essentially we traded bands, you know, at the end of 1984. I joined the Reston bands, and then he joined the Malifies band. He was also very short with them. I think he only played one or two shows. And then they got a guy named Billy Fox, who I still know today. So most of the Malifies we know and love is Billy Fox.
Where was Malifies based out of?
The high school in Vienna, not Oakton, the other one, Marshall, I think it was called, Marshall High School. I could be wrong. No, Marshall's different. Man, I forget the high school in Vienna. But Malifies is based out of Vienna, Fairfax.
Okay. I mean,
Madison High School.
Yes. That's nowhere close to Bethesda either, though.
Eventually I did move to Reston, and I think that was after Foundation. I think I was still in Sterling, and then I briefly lived in Germantown, Maryland, when I was playing with Foundation with Mike, and then Ron Winters, who you've also interviewed, was in Foundation when I was living in Maryland. But I think we practiced, and we must have practiced at my mom's house in Sterling.
Now, did you record it all with Malifies, or was that all, it was just live shows?
Well, they did a really good recording with the first drummer, with Jim, the guy who wouldn't play live.
Mm-hmm.
And then that didn't come out until like 5, 6, 7 years later on a bootleg in Germany. But I played on their single, Overboard. And it's the last time I'm going to mention Dave Grohl, I swear. But I met Dave Grohl. I played a show with him in 87 in Pennsylvania. And he's like, man, I used to take that Malifies record and put my headphones on and drum along to it. And I don't know if he's just blowing smoke up my ass, because my drumming is not very good on that single, but I'm never going to forget much fact that Dave used to come along to my single. Makes me feel really good.
Yeah, that's a pretty great compliment. So Foundation, once you joined that band, where did you guys go from there?
It kind of mirrored Media Disease to a certain extent. I mean, the Pudwack was kind of a comedy band. You know, you don't want to say joke band, but that's what you say about someone else's band. You don't call your own band a joke band.
I mean, they would say that their songs were intended to be funny, you know, that they weren't taking themselves very seriously at all. I liked a lot of the Pudwack songs. You know, had you seen Pudwack play when
yeah,
they were...
They played with Malifies at a Respite Community Center. DC 101 Battle of the Bands, I think. I could be getting my shows confused.
No,
I think they played that show.
First one to tell me about that show, and he was there in the audience.
Who was that?
Brian Stewart, who went on...
Oh, yes. Yes.
...and now I'm Ruined by Design, told me that he was in the audience at that show. And that was part of what gave him the idea for Jam for Man.
Yeah, it was pretty fun. There was a band called Guys Who Like Snacks. First cover band. It was just a whole potpourri of South Lakes High School bands for the most part. But, yeah, Foundation played in Brian's house, I think. At Brian Stewart's house. I think it was his house at a party. And, yeah, I met Brian probably that day. We played at his house. But, yeah, Foundation was not successful with the other DC bands. We kind of had, like, we had friends. Like, we knew the Dag Nasty guys. We knew Gray Matter guys, this and that. But, yeah, we had a hard time getting shows as well. But we went on tour. Like, the tour was pretty fun. Mike kind of left out a really great story. Maybe like his, you know, he doesn't want it to be out there. I don't know, but we played in Detroit. Like, you know, 5, 6, 7 bands playing in Detroit. And I'm watching, we played really early. We played at 1 in the afternoon, 2 in the afternoon. And some guy's like, hey, are you in that band Foundation? I'm like, yeah. He's like, oh, there's skinheads out back, and they're trying to turn your bus over. We had Dag Nasty's tour bus, which was like a short school bus. And so I'm like, well, I need to get out there and see what's going on. And I get out there, and the promoter of the show is yelling with a bunch of skinheads, and they've all got guns. They're just kind of waving them in the air at each other. And I guess the skinheads got kicked out of the show. And so they went back, and they were going to turn our school bus over just because it happened to be there. And then this old man in bib overalls and no shirt comes out, who lives in the alley, and he's got a gun. So there's the promoter, whose name was Scary, and he's now in prison for murder, I think, but he was a nice guy at the time. And skinheads, the guy comes out. I'm like, okay, I'm going back in. The three guns, and I'm out. But as I'm going back in, it all just dissipated. Everyone just put their guns away. the skinheads went away, the old man went away, and the show didn't get canceled. I'm trying to imagine the show in D.C. where guns are drawn, and the show's not canceled, but it didn't get canceled. And so then I see Mike Davis later on. I'm like, hey, Mike, I got to tell you about what happened to our bus. And he's like, I was in the bus. I was hiding in the bus while they were trying to turn the bus over.
He must have been so traumatized. He's forgotten.
Maybe. But that's, and then Ron, our bass player, somehow he missed it all. I don't think he went back there. I can't recall. But so that story is out there now. That's good. But yeah, well, I mean, touring with Foundation was pretty fun. But then, you know, sometimes they would give us beer not to play because we'd, you know, play these festivals of, you know, seven bands, and we'd always be one of the first bands, and there's no one there is there yet. Like, nobody paid. And they're like, hey, can we just give you beer not to play? And we're like, okay. We like beer.
You said that with Media Disease, it was that you didn't feel like you guys were really good enough to garner that sort of notice or to play DC or be regarded as up there with any of those bands around that time. Did you feel the same way about Foundation?
To a certain extent, I didn't feel that we were as good as the DC bands. No, our songwriting, our best songwriter was Dave Allen. From the first album, he wrote a song called Voyage. It's really great. And then It's Not As Bad As You Think. And then our bass player, Sean, he would just come out and say, we're not very good. Like, people don't want to book us. We're just not a good band. And he eventually quit. I still see him. I saw him last month. Like, there's nothing. Realizing your band isn't that great is not a horrible thing to realize. But, we were an okay band. I mean, at the time, you know, it was fun. But we weren't Grey Matter. We weren't Rites of Spring. We weren't Beefeater quality.
Well, I mean, a good portion of that band goes on to be branch manager, which is, you know, a pretty highly regarded band. You know, you've certainly been in your fair share of great bands.
I think the band after that, Repercussion, I'm pretty proud of some of that stuff. Like I say, like Mike said, I wanted to be a singer. It's hard to sing and play drums. It's hard to write melodies when the songs are based around guitar riffs. And I'd met this guy, Jeff Keglarkin, at a party. And he was friends with the 13-year-old bass player. He was now, like, 17. And we got together for some reason, and we're, like, we were working on a song together. It was the Media Disease bass player, Jeff, and me. And he was very easy to work with. Like, I would sing a melody, and then he had some musical training. He's like, oh, you're going from this chord to this chord. And see, I can play the melody and the chords. And I'm like, that's brilliant. I need someone like you that I can just write a melody, and then you can come up with the music. And then, plus I was around 26 or 27 then, and I'm like, I want to be a singer before I'm 30, because after you're 30, you know, just put a fork in it. So I left Foundation because at that time you couldn't really do two bands at once. It just wasn't done. Although Foundation did play two or three shows after I joined Repercussion, because our album had come out and we'd spent a lot of time and money putting that album out, so we wanted to play some shows. But just working with Repercussion, it was easier for me to come up with songs with them. And plus, you know, I didn't want to play drums, I wanted to sing. And I had that deadline of being 30. And that was a very, very fun band. And artistically, I'm proud of it. And we didn't play many DC shows either. There's like a common thread. But we discovered this great Reston scene. The genesis of your podcast is how amazing this Reston scene just came out of nowhere, where we could play Jam for Man and there'd be 300 people there, 400 people there. We would sell 30 or 50 cassettes. We'd sell 20 t-shirts. It was more fun than the DC scene in some ways.
Well, how did you get hooked up with this Reston scene? Or how did you discover that this was going on?
Brian Stewart. Everyone's going to say Brian Stewart. I think Repercussion had trouble getting in with the Reston scene because I was so damn old. Like Avail, there's interviews where they're like, we're the youth of the scene. We celebrate our youthfulness. And then here's this band. Oh, that guy's like 27 years old. And somehow we got a garage show in Reston. I think we played with Remission. And it was a good show. And Brian was there, maybe Joe from Avail. And like, oh, we got to hook these guys up. This is, we've been mistaken having this this age prejudice. It's unwarranted. And so we played a few shows with Avail, DC Space, Jam for Man. They were delightful to work with.
And so you said you played 3 Jam for Man.
I know we played at least 2. I feel that we played 3. One was with Avail, and one was with maybe Transilient. It was in the spring. I remember the poster had spring flowers on it. And then a later show, maybe 91. I had already joined Lorelei by 91 because I was 30. I'm done with hardcore, but we had the Repercussion cassette out. Like, oh, we got to promote the cassette. So I did both bands for a while. And that was the only time my dad ever saw me play with the Jam for Man in 91.
What do you remember from that?
I think I hadn't seen him in a while because he lived out in Woodbridge. I'm like, oh, playing in Reston, because my dad lived in Reston in the 70s. In fact, he lived in the same development as Mike Davis and Steve Niles. But, I would have been 15 and those guys were like 7. But in theory, I saw them on their skateboards out in our backyard, 5, 6, 7 years before I met them, which is weird.
Yeah, they would have been old enough to join your band.
I think so, yeah. That's back when I was still listening to Fleetwood Mac and Argent. But yeah, so my dad showed up, and I think he had, a date with him or something, and the people in Reston like knew the words to the Trees and the Flowers, to the Repercussion songs. It was like we were a big deal, like in terms of impressing my dad.
Well, speaking of those songs, because you sent me those songs, and that's how I was able to hear them. I think that that record is just it's one of the best albums I've ever heard from that time and from Northern Virginia. It's up there with any.
Well, thanks. It's 3 years of songwriting. It wasn't just, you know, here's our 12 songs we have. Like, since we'd only put out a few cassettes of, you know, EPs, that was pretty much, here's our, you know, the 12 best songs of our whole time together. But there was lots of songwriting. Some of the lyrics I'm really happy with. Some lyrics I would just write on the way to band practice at a stoplight and whatnot. And maybe I would change it 3 months later. Pick a couple of those on there. Population, I'm not too happy with. And, but yet, lyrically, I'm pretty happy with Repercussion. Jeff Keglarkin also wrote some lyrics for that.
I mean, it's funny how much you're looking back already, though, at 27. You know, in terms of your lyrics, like how sort of nostalgic or thinking about the choices that you've made in life already to that point, that stuff seems to come out in your lyrics.
Yeah, I mean, some of that is, you know, based upon who I am. And then a lot of it is just being a character. Like, I felt writing lyrics, like, I'm not a writer, but I felt I would be kind of literary and I would make up a character and make up a backstory. And then people would think, oh, did this really happen to you? Because that's, you know, hardcore. If you have a lyric, oh, this happened to that guy, and you wrote the song. And I'd have to tell them, no, none of these bad things have happened to me. I'm just creating a character and creating a scenario that doesn't necessarily exist. But then, yeah, a lot of the stuff about, you know, life choices and looking back, but that's all the real me.
Well, what about, like, let's say a song like Childhood Friend?
Well, that's Jeff's lyric. And actually, that lyric is about the Media Disease bass player, who was Jeff's childhood friend, who had moved, either gone to college or moved away. I guess he'd moved away for college. And he was determining that they're becoming out of touch with one another. So he had the genesis of that song, and then I just took his theme, and I think I wrote the verses. But it was based upon the song idea he had come up with for the chorus.
It's a beautiful song. And the recording of it is quite advanced.
That's our great band. The drummer, J.P. Evans, we had him, and then he went to college. We got a guy named Chris, and then a guy named Danny McGee, who played on the Trees and the Flowers cassette.
And then, he's from Transylvania.
Yes, he was from Transylvania, yes. But then J.P. came back for an extended summer, and we're like, man, we can either play for 4 months with JP or keep playing with Danny. But we really, really enjoyed playing with our first drummer. And so we kept JP for that summer, and we did the album recording with JP. And JP's brother had joined the band, John, and he was the recording guru. Like, I wish I'd paid more attention to how he got some of those drum sounds. Because he was very meticulous. He was not punk rock in any way. Like, he let me get away with having kind of punky vocals. Because I could always say that Neil Young doesn't sing in key, and he was a big Neil Young fan. I think he wanted more professional-sounding vocals from me. But he lived with the vocals I gave him. But he was very very detail-oriented, and he was able to make that sound. You know, it's a 8-track reel-to-reel, and it sounds like a 16-track.
I mean, that guy was super talented as a producer.
Oh, yeah.
Seriously, I mean, the record sounds better than anything else from that time.
He works for, I think, NPR now. He's in Minneapolis. So he is an engineer. He doesn't do many bands. He might do bands.
He should.
I only see him over Christmas and whatnot.
Well, you know, that album, it seems to me, could have gone right up on the radio. You know, it's not a hardcore punk album. It's a rock album. And it, I don't know, it feels very accessible to me. I'm not saying it was like poppy or anything, but I just think that people would have really, really connected to those songs. Like you said, the kids from Reston knew all the lyrics.
Yeah, I was always shocked that people, you know, were relating to the lyrics, because I'm, you know, the common theme, I'm 10 years older than everybody who's listening to the album. And so for me to be able to write something that someone younger than me can identify with felt good. And just the whole Reston scene was so positive. Compared to the DC scene, they had kind of, you know, it's cliquish. Although, I mean, I went to shows in DC every twice a week. You know, it was a very special time in the early 80s, and we knew it. Like, we knew we were, you know, the hardcore scene in D.C. was going to be something that was going to last forever. It's a very, you know, from 81 to 86, it's just an amazing period of music that, you know, they're still making documentaries about to this day. But anyway, but so Media Disease, I mean, sorry, Repercussion was a good experience, but, you know, every band, I feel, has an expiration date. And then Jeff wanted to go to college out of town. So he went to music school in Boston. JP, when he graduated college, moved to Texas. So it's a question of we don't even want to do the band without JP.
I mean, did you guys consider, or did you send it to any labels, any radio stations? Was there any consideration?
I sent it to Discord. Yeah, it's probably the only thing I ever sent to Discord. And Ian sent me back a letter. Oh, thanks for the cassette. But I mean, it was full of guitar solos, and
yeah, I mean, you know, it was
not a Discord album in any way, so.
But it could have played on WHFS, or it could have played on DC 101, like, very easily.
Perhaps, but, you know, just things come to an end. People move away.
Sure.
It's a happy experience.
You know, because during that time, there was a lot, and especially from that, like, hardcore scene, there was a lot of, you know, ideas of if you were on the radio or whatever, you were selling out. You know, or you'd gone commercial and, like, fuck that. Was that part of the attitude?
No, we had the opposite. I think there was a Pat Benatar song called, like, Kick It Out, or a total just cock rock song from Pat Benatar. And somehow it came up, and me and Jeff were talking about it, and we're like, man, we both really like this Pat Benatar song. Like, why are we limiting ourselves to hardcore tropes? And, you know, we're not doing very well in the hardcore scene. Let's branch the music out in some way, and, you know, let the genre, we don't care. If people don't like it, we don't care. Let's do something that's not hemmed in because of some Pat Benatar song that I can't recall. But that was our first demo was total hardcore. our second demo, pretty hardcore. And by the trees and flowers, you know, we'd started to branch out to something that it's commercial suicide not to be a genre, not to be something you could pigeonhole. But, you know, we didn't care. We were young and just wanted to make music. And the fact that the rest in shows, the people liked it, that was enough for us.
What's your favorite song on that album?
Like JP, the drummer, he's like, all my musician friends like Voice from the Past, which is a total, like, doesn't have a big hook. It's just a total musician-y type song. And I remember Jeff and I writing that one. Like, I was playing bass, he was playing guitar, and he had a riff, and then I changed the second part. I'm like, oh, I've got a bass, but let's go here. And the melody and the words and the music all came in that one, you know, 45-minute session. It's very fun to write. So I think that's my favorite song, is A Voice from Your Past. Then lyrically, Another New Day on side two of the album. I enjoy that one quite a bit. And Nocturne in E minor is kind of a diabolical song that I enjoy.
That's funny. That's the only one I don't really like that much.
Well, I'm going to make you like it.
at least on the first side.
Do you know there's a Pink Floyd song? I stole the rhyme pattern from the Pink Floyd song, like Cold Steel Rails. I think it's Wish You Were Here. Like, I did an exercise where I took the couplets of Wish You Were Here and then wrote bizarre lyrics that would end up with that couplet. So the rhyme scheme of that, a part of that song, is from Pink Floyd.
Yeah, well, unlike most punks, I like Pink Floyd a lot. I grew up listening to a lot of Pink Floyd. So,
yeah, I wish I could name the Pink Floyd song, but yeah. It was just an exercise I played with myself of just to write songs. I wasn't like, I couldn't just write a song. I would write a song about, you know, seeing a road, like the chopping broccoli school of songwriting. I would see a road sign and write a song about the road sign. But then when I wasn't writing crap like that, I think I had some good lyrics.
And that train one has some killer bass on it.
That's a different bass player. That's their JP and John's neighbor. He was a music school guy. And just doing the most unpunk rock bass of all time. He was at the conservatory in Winchester. And so we have him on two songs on the album. And it's just, you know, so anti-punk rock, we're like, okay, let's put this weird, you know, techno jazz guy bass line on here.
Well, speaking of anti-punk rock, let's talk about Lorelei. Because Lorelei is pretty far from punk rock.
Yeah, I mean, they're, like, you know, I was 30, and I'm like, nobody wants to see a 30-year-old guy on stage. I'm going to just be the guy in the background of the band. If I have a commitment, it can't make the show, the band can still play. And I also kind of felt that during the punk rock time, you want to make albums that are timeless. Like, you want to make Abbey Road. You want to make, you know, an album that people are going to keep talking about forever. But in the 90s, I started hearing stuff from England, like the Charlatans UK and stuff on HFS. And like, this is interesting, but I think this music is only of this time, and it's kind of disposable, and it's really fun, but it's not something that people are going to talk about. You know, after the hardcore scene of the 80s, I knew that would live forever. So I kind of had a mental attitude of, like, I'm just going to make music for now. Like, I don't care about the legacy. I don't care about, you know, what people are going to think about it. And so I met the guy from Lorelei, which goes into another common theme. We were at a Halloween party at AU, and he was 15 and I was 30. And he had seen Repercussion. Actually, he had played a show with Repercussion in his band. And he's like, hey, you're the guy from Repercussion. And unlike most 15-year-olds, he was like 6'6" and was pretty much an adult. He wasn't a 15-year-old kid. He was just a 15-year-old adult. And so I talked to him for like 2 hours that night about the Charlatans. He's like, oh, there's all this cool UK music with, it's called shoegaze and the swirly effects. And it's got dance beats. And he starts, you know, doing the beat. And I'm like, oh, that would be fun. And so I was playing mandolin then. So I joined the band as the mandolin player. And we got guitar player Dave, and we auditioned a bunch of singers. We went through, like, I think 2 singers, maybe 4 drummers. And I'm friends with all the previous drummers. And we put out a single on Slumberland with Gina singing. And then, as always happens, the guitar player went to college. So the first generation of Lorelei was very poppy and, you know, a girl singer. But we decided we had to replace the guitar player because we had a single coming out. And the guitar player who replaced him was Matt. He was not poppy. He was abrasive. And suddenly the band just didn't work anymore. The band was completely not functional. And we played a really bad show at CMJ. And, like, the drummer quit. I think the singer, she maybe quit. And I had been practicing, like, if the drummer didn't show up at practice, I would drum. And that was starting to sound really good. In fact, the band was starting to sound really good when people didn't show up. It was just the three of us. It was Matt and Steven and me. And we decided we're just going to reconceptualize the band as this trio. And that's the Lorelei that's done all this stuff.
Okay. And
I don't know if I told that story. I was trying to be concise, but it might be impossible to be concise.
It's funny. It's interesting how you bounce from, you know, the drums to doing, to going to singing, then to the mandolin, then back to the drums, you know. You come back to your first love, the drum, eventually. But you gotta stretch out and do all these other things just to satisfy a different creative itch.
Well, if you're a drummer out there listening to this, the best thing you can do is not play drums. Play something else, and you're going to come across some really good drummers and some really annoying drummers and some bad drummers who mess up your time. And you kind of see what the function of a drummer is by not drumming. Like, in those 5 years I wasn't drumming, or 3 years, whatever it was, that was the best thing that ever happened to me drum-wise, because I worked with other drummers, and I was a musician trying to play to the drums and determining, like, oh, this is really easy to play to JP, or, oh, my God, this is really difficult because the drummer's too busy and the time is switching all around. So if you want to be a drummer that people want to work with, do something else for a while and experience having to put up with a drummer. And then you'll become someone that people can put up with, hopefully. That's my lesson for the kids today.
That's super great, useful advice. I doubt a lot of drummers are going to take it, but I think that that's awesome advice. And I could see how that would work really well. Which is your favorite of the Lorelei? You like the later version of the band as compared to the original conception?
Well, the original band was more fun because the guy, Dave, the guitar player, he was fun as hell. Oh, my God, I love hanging out with him. I mean, that band was only January to September of 90, I believe. Maybe 91. And, when he moved away to go to Cal Arts, go to college, that was horrible. But we only had one really great song, which was the single, The Bitter Air. In fact, there's a movie called something about High School Wallflower. What was this movie called? Perks of Being a Wallflower?
Yeah.
They approached us about using The Bitter Air in a gymnasium scene. I haven't seen the movie, but the woman who does the sound licensing was way into it, and then she sent it to whoever makes these decisions. But that song was recorded on an 8-track. The drums are in mono. It's a completely crude recording. So it wasn't used in the movie. I can't remember who replaced us in the soundtrack. Like, when the album came out, I'm like, oh, my God, are we on here? And I forget what band is in the scene. But, yeah, it was a very crude recording, unfortunately. But that song is most Lorelei fans like that song and don't like anything we did after. if you're going by YouTube comments. But personally, I like the band when it switched to a more harder edge, you know, power trio.
What's the best example of what you guys were doing?
Well, we only did one album in the 90s, Everyone Must Touch the Stove, and an EP called Asleep. And, the album, I think, if you like that, that's our sound. And we did a 25th anniversary show. We played the whole album, I guess, 3 years ago at the Black Cat, because a blog had written about it. And we were just happy to get any attention. So we wrote this voluminous response to his blog questions. It's probably, it could probably take you 20 minutes to read this blog of how we made the album. And we get together and did the whole album in order at the Black Hat. We never played the whole album before. And the gist of the podcast or the article is that we kind of predated Radiohead. Like Radiohead gets kind of fractured songs and it's kind of, you know, blurry and it's not hooky. They're like, oh, you know, these guys could have been Radiohead.
Hmm.
And we're like, well, not really. But yeah, we were doing that stuff before it was commercially popular to do.
So after Lorelei, what are the highlights?
Well, we went around to from like 90, 91, like 96, 97, and then Matt moved to San Francisco. He does technical coding, cell phone apps and stuff like that. And there's no way you're going to replace Matt, although we did have a period. He had moved, and we had auditioned a singer to replace him. But then he immediately moved back.
Hmm.
And so he rejoined. But then when he moved for good, we're like, okay, that's the end of the band. You know, we've got on each other's nerves. Lorelei was kind of a dysfunctional band in many respects. I compare us, not artistically, but in terms of the group dynamic, to the Police. Like there's Sting, and then there's Stuart Copeland, which was me, and then our bass player was probably Andy Summers. Like we would definitely get on each other's nerves and just be downright outwardly aggressive to one another. But it worked. The music worked. The band dynamic was torturous, which is maybe how the Police are able to make good music, too.
But it's funny, you guys stayed together longer than just about any of your other bands.
Well, we had an audience and critics, bless them, they seemed to like us. We got good write-ups. And I'm like, you know, I could go, what else am I going to do? Why am I going to quit a band that HFS will play us? They had a local music show on Sundays. And I would just send them, oh, here's, you know, a demo we did. It would put it right in the radio. I'm like, okay, that's good. No other band on the other side is going to have that kind of response. So yeah. We just kind of, you know, you've got to make sacrifices in a band. Everybody has different reasons they're in the band. And you have to kind of not get your way and be okay with it, being a band like that.
Well, so were you, after that, were you focusing on playing, or were you focusing on recording more?
I started recording teenage bands, like, because I had, between Repercussion and Lorelei, I bought a whole lot of recording gear. Microphones, a big mixer, a Mackie mixing board. And so I would just bring it all to teenage bands. Somehow, it's like, oh, you got to get Davis White from Lorelei to record you. And I didn't have the talent that John Evans had, the guy who recorded Repercussion. But I could get a sound on tape, and it was decent. And we would do it very quickly. So I would bring my stuff to a band's practice space and, you know, do 4 or 5 songs, 3 songs. Sometimes I did a whole album. So I did that from 96 to 2001.
And did you have good success with those bands? I mean, did you feel, you know, satisfied with any of the recordings that you made during that time?
Yeah, a bunch came out. I mean, probably 5 or 6 albums came out on CD. And, like, it's not brilliant engineering, but sometimes the band, this one band, Gen Hit, their album came out really well. And then their guitar player, he became a really good engineer. And finally, I'm like, you don't need to record with me. Like, you're better than me. Just record yourself. And he started recording his own band.
Not a great sales model.
No, no. I mean, I didn't charge very much. Like, when Foundation Time, I was spending a lot of money at Inner Ear. That album took, like, a year to make. And we would, like, go in for a weekend. And then, like, oh, man, I got to save up $700 or $800 before we can go back. And so we'd go back 4 months later. Because I worked at a print shop and made, like, you know, $8 an hour. So when I recorded high school bands, I'm like, I'm not going to charge these guys a lot of money. I'm going to charge them, you know, $200 for everything.
Well, so now you're still recording.
Yeah, I'm still.
Thanks.
I did electronic music for, you know, I'm like, forget being 30. Then I was 40. I'm like, nobody wants to see a 40-year-old guy on stage. I'm just going to do synthesizer music. Because that scene, there's a scene in D.C. called Sonic Circuits. It's very welcoming. You could be just anybody and be accepted. But then I got pulled back into rock and roll when Matt and Lorelei moved back into D.C. after being gone for 15 years. And Lorelei did another album. And I played with a band called Rambling Shadows, who were all guys my age, doing kind of garage rock for 5 years. And I played with a band called Sanju, semi-recently, instrumental trio. And then around 2 years ago, I joined this band called We Capillaries that I'm currently in. We played Fort Reno last summer. This is cool guy, Pierre. He's kind of like my new Jeff Keglarkin. Like, I can just play ideas off of him, and he doesn't have a preconceived idea of what the music should be. Like, we can together come up with something that didn't exist before we sat down together. Like, it's very collaborative, even though he's the main songwriter and whatnot. But there's a sense of collaboration that I really enjoy for the first time since Repercussion, really. So we put out an album a year ago called People Food. It's on iTunes and Spotify and Wee Capillary's People Food. And we're working on a new album now. I think it's going kind of slow, but yeah, it's the first time since Repercussion I really felt like I'm in a collaborative think tank that's very satisfying.
And it has, then how would you describe the sound? I would say it has some of those shoegaze elements that you were sort of exploring on that first Lorelei.
A few. It's more weirdo, like weirdo rock is what we call it. It could just be, you know, there's a reggae song, there's a ballad, there's a garage rock song. I'm kind of in the back of this situation of like, I don't care about being commercial. I don't care about being pigeonholed. I'm just going to do something that feels good.
Well, it not only feels good, it sounds good. I think it's got a big sound, you know, and it's wide open. And you're right, it goes in a lot of directions. But I love that. Being somebody that, you know, loves a lot of different genres of music.
Probably most people are like that. Most people are very eclectic. But it's just, if you're doing a band and you want to be a successful band, you have to be, with some exceptions, you've got to be pigeonholed.
See, and I don't agree with that. And I know that is the common, like, wisdom. But, you know, a lot of my favorite artists are not like that.
That's good. I've recently got into, I got a Apple Music account.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have to buy music. I can just, I'm renting it as I listen. Okay, I guess I spend $10 a month.
Yeah.
So just in the past, since September, I discovered this artist named Mitski.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, she's amazing. I'm going to see her in Baltimore next month. And Sharon Van Etten put out an album. I think it's February. It's probably the best album of the year. Like, you're going to have a hard time topping it. And she'd actually come to see, I was playing in a band in Brooklyn. I still am, called the New Lines. And she had given us an email, like, oh, I'd like to come see you guys. This is around 3 years ago. And so she came to one of our shows in Manhattan. But I hadn't heard her. But then when I got the Apple Music account, like, Sharon Van Etten is just amazing songwriter. So I'm, after, you know, a long period of not really discovering new music, thanks to the Apple Music, I'm discovering new music every week. It's really, you know, I would have thought that good music wasn't being made now, but it is.
Yeah, you've got to try out a lot of stuff and, you know, be open to different kinds of things, which it sounds like you totally are. And it sounds like you really like female vocals also.
Well, I like the, it's a big hole. I like those two current artists who are very similar to one another. It really grabbed me. They had just songs from the heart, and maybe they're doing their own characters. Maybe that's not Mitski. But if I hear it, I'm like, this sounds like all this stuff happened to her, and it's dramatic and joyful, and all the emotions sound like they're in the song. Same with Sharon Van Etten. I'm a big fan of The Pretenders and The Selector. But not a whole lot of female artists between early 80s and now, I don't think. I think I just hadn't, because I don't listen to too much new music. Like the 90s, the grunge scene, I didn't have very many female artists to begin with, vocalists in that scene. So it's good. Yeah, it's good to discover these artists later in life.
So let me ask you one sort of selfish question.
All right.
Is there any chance of a Repercussion reunion?
Well, when I had my 50th birthday, I did a strange party where I tried to assemble all my ex-bandmates that I could find. I scoured the globe. And all the ones who could get here, who could drive or live close, I think around 6 bands played. Like every band played 1, 2, or 3 songs. And the closest I got to Repercussion was I got the drummer's brother-in-law on drums, Evan, JP's brother-in-law. And I played bass and sang. And my bandmate in a country band at the time, Eli, learned note for note the guitar parts. He corresponded with Jeff in Boston. Jeff taught him how to play the 3 songs on guitar. So we did Another Useless Organ, Brother Whisper, and an unreleased song called Pesky Critters at my birthday party. And that's probably the closest. Maybe over Christmas we could do it, but like one guy's in Texas, one guy is in Boston, and one guy is in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and I am in Virginia. So it would be really unlikely to happen.
Well, since you're in Virginia, I just want to extend the invite to you. We're trying to put together a Jam for Man anniversary show, like a 30th anniversary of Jam for Man. And unfortunately, the Reston Community Center won't cooperate. So it may not be in Reston. It may have to be in Falls Church. So I don't know what you have planned this summer.
Let me write it down. Are you able to find bands that can play?
Yeah. I mean, look, most of the musicians that are playing with their current bands, and these are just people that played Jam for Man, but are going to play with their current bands. Spooky is looking to put a version of Transilience together.
Oh, my stars. Okay, I got to be there.
Of, like, Reston All Stars. So I do, you know, since you played, you're welcome to play with We Capillaries. Or
is it 2 months from now, July, whatever? I'm pretty sure We Capillaries can learn 1 or 2 Repercussion songs, if that will placate you. And then do the rest of our set. I mean, we can do a short set. Cool. Yeah, keep me in the loop. I will talk to my bandmates.
I think we've done a pretty good job here today.
Cool, and yeah. Thanks for thinking of me.
I really appreciate you doing this. And, like, honestly, I was so blown away by listening to that album last night and today and again today. I just really loved it, and I've really connected with a lot of your music, but especially that Trees and Flowers album. I just think, I mean, you should remaster it and put it out there. You should get so much of this music that's not out there, but particularly that one.
I'm working on it.
I really think I'm not just trying to gush. I really think it's a masterpiece.
Question mark.
not at all. Period. It is a masterpiece, and I loved it. I love what you're doing on that album. I think it's great, and I think everybody that didn't have a chance to hear it before should hear it. Like really, everybody should hear it. I'm honestly surprised it wasn't a huge hit.
Well, nothing was a hit. I mean, it's the first Avail cassette hit. I mean, we love it, but it's any of that stuff, you know, is Remission a hit? I love it.
I know. But
it's a hit in Rustin.
For me, I think so many of the musicians that were playing during that time, that was a jumping off point. You know, that kick-started them into a life in music.
Yeah.
And sometimes you don't, you know, sometimes you don't start making your best music to your 50s and 60s. Or
I'll let you know. We'll see how my next 3 years come out.
I will be listening to every Wee Capillaries album that comes out and everything you put out.
All right. Well, thank you, sir.
Sure. And thank you. Seriously, thank you for being a part of this.